Was at section, or just getting into section 7 of my legal submissions.
Yes.
So this section is about the council's position on site specific rules. We have covered this to an extent already, but in the upper public hearing, the panel did ask the council to clarify its position in terms of whether it is appropriate for the likes of a site specific rule or structure plan or deferred zone to be included in the proposed district plan. Under a deferred zone or even under a number of rules, depending how that's drafted, this would mean that development under the zone type would be contingent on a certain event occurring. So Council's position is that site-specific rules, structure plans and deferred zones are not supported where there is no evidence that the relevant infrastructure required to service the enabled capacity, i.e. waters and transport, to be either upgraded or constructed, or where there is no desire or likelihood to commit to funding within the long-term plan for that project. However, a site-specific rule of this nature or use of a deferred zone, however phrased, which provides that no development can go ahead until a certain work has been completed, may be appropriate in circumstances where there is an anticipated upgrade required to the roading network. And I will ask you to delete the next sentence, please. So in the public hearing, Ms. Wendy Banks was asked to consider this matter in her reply. In this hearing, we've asked her to do that in advance. So yeah. Assist the panel in terms of being clear in terms of whether it is her concerns could be addressed, for example, through the subdivision chapter, or whether a site-specific rule preventing development occurring until a certain upgrade takes place, or whether simply she's opposed to the rezoning. But section 8 is just a very brief note to remind the panel and also submitters that for any new zones that may come into the proposed district plan via a rezoning submission, that the definitions in chapter 2 of the plan, which is the definitions chapter, would be triggered.
And there's obviously they sought a new definition to be included.
Yes, unless that's correct. Yes. Right, section 9, annotations across and rezonings relating to stages 2 to 4 and volume B land. This has been covered by a number of minutes and memoranda over the last short period of time, but for the purposes of this hearing, what is relevant is that the Council accepts that the panel will not hear submissions or evidence from the Council or submitters in relation to notations on the maps notified over or sought via submission to be included over stages 2 to 4 land and or volume B land. Logically, the panel's minute also applies to the component of Queenstown Park submission requesting a new subzone over the operative Remarkables Park zone, as well as a number of other submissions seeking, for example, overlays over stages 2 to 4 and volume B land. For Queenstown Park, the consequence of the panel's minute is that the panel has no jurisdiction over that part of the proposed subzone and Gondola Corridor and the Gondola Terminal that was proposed to be located across the Marquis Park Zone. And that approach would appear consistent with Mr. Young's submissions about the panel's jurisdiction filed in the context of the ONL notified over the Marquis Park Zone. And it follows that the lower portion of any gondola and the bottom terminal station would need to obtain consent under the operative Marquis Park Zone provisions. This approach also applies to rezonings of either stages 2 to 4 and for volume B land, which has been the Council's approach in any event as it's prepared for this hearing. This approach appears to be challenged in the evidence of Mr. Vivian for Arcadia Station and Daryl Sampson and Louise Cooper, when Mr. Vivian asserts that all of submission 480 and the part of submission 495 relating to the operative rural visitor zone at Arthur's Point were within the scope and they were made. This issue has been traversed earlier in the hearings and in the various memoranda that has been filed in any event, this issue falls within the panel's minutes referred to above. In short, Council's position is that the rural visitor, Arthur's Point Zone, was not notified in stage one, no chapter or zone provisions were notified, and the ODP zone was shown information purposes only on the planning maps. In response to the panel's minute more generally, in order to assist the panel, because the panel's minute was released after Council's evidence in chief was filed, the Council's witnesses, where relevant, has set out in their rebuttal evidence the parts of their evidence in chief that relates to planning map annotations over stages 2 to 4 or volume B land. So essentially that evidence, I understand, can essentially be more for the purposes of this hearing.
Yes.
Turning to submitter requests for operative district plan zones. So a number of submitters have sought that their land, which was notified in stage one, be rezoned to an operative district plan zone, for example, to an industrial, four-wheel visitor, or visitor accommodation subzone, which are being reviewed through a later stage of the review. As the land in question has been notified with the proposed zone on the stage one planning maps, submissions are on land notified in stage one, no matter what zone type they are pursuing, and are within this panel's jurisdiction. Of relevance, the Council accepts the view expressed by the panel in 2 minutes, dated 29 May and 8 June, that where a submitter has chosen to pursue an operative district plan zoning, such as the rural visitor zone, the test of giving effect to and implementing the strategic directions chapters remains relevant. In addition, Council agrees with two other matters raised by the panel in its 29 May minute, that there is no evidence that those operative zones become part of the proposed plan, and the panel will need to understand the entire objective policy and rule framework proposed so the panel can understand what actual and potential effects on the environment rezoning would have and whether that was consistent with the overall objectives and policies of the proposed district plan.
In order to make, if we were, for argument's sake, we're interested in pursuing that, we would have to essentially import the ODP zone or a version of it into the PDP, wouldn't we?
Yes, you would, procedurally. And what I'm going to get to in the next paragraph is that the structure of the proposed district plan is different to the operative district plan, so it's not as simple as basically getting a chapter and slotting it into the proposed district plan.
Or perhaps create something similar that did fit in with the PDP.
Yes. So if a submitter seeks to rely on the operative provisions or chapter unaltered, there are some difficulties in that because the entire structure of the proposed district plan is different, and that includes the strategic chapters but also the district-wide chapters that that the chapter would end up sitting and working alongside. Some of these changes may generally be non-substantive and structural, but the working evaluation still needs to happen. In this hearing stream, it is submitted that no submitter has satisfied this evidential threshold. One submitter, Lachlan Station, has suggested inserting controls over maximum footprint and height, as well as a requirement that no buildings at the Y Creek site be visible from the state highway. Sorry, typo, that should be these new rules are suggested to slot into the operative rural visitor zone. But the evidence does not assess how the operative rural visitor zone will fit into the proposed district plan as is submitted to be needed. Overall, therefore, it is submitted that the panel cannot, based on the evidence before it, include in the proposed district plan by way of rezoning submission any of the operative zones, and if you could just delete the reference to see table below. As there is not the evidential foundation before this panel, nor does it have the necessary proposed district plan provisions to do so. If a submitter had brought the necessary level of evidence and satisfied the Council that an operative zone type with the necessary amendments to the chapter allowing it to fit into the proposed plan structure and give effect to and implement the strategic chapters, integrate with the Stage 1 district-wide chapters, as well as satisfying the Council that the zone chapter itself met the statutory tests, then the Council will need to consider that evidence on its face. It will need to do this in the same way that other bespoke zones, such as the proposed Queenstown Park Special Zone, are being evaluated. The unfortunate outcome of this staged process is that there is a possibility that a site may end up with a bespoke zone in the proposed special plan. If this submitter meets the evidential threshold that I've just gone through, as the council will still be reviewing the operative rural visitor township and industrial zones, and for example the visitor accommodation subzone through stages 2 to 4. If this was to be the outcome, there is a possible avenue where the council may look to notify a variation for any bespoke zone that ended up in the proposed district plan via a rezoning submission. For example, if the submitter was able to meet all the thresholds and satisfy the panel that the ODB rural visitor zone is appropriate, there may be a way of revisiting that in the future.
So you're not suggesting here, as some of the reporting officers have suggested, is that things that they agree with, but I can't see a way of doing it at the moment. They've often regularly suggested a later variation, but that's not what you're dealing with here, is it?
Yes, I'm going to get to that just now, but there are a number of scenarios in terms of the different submissions, and so what I've endeavoured to do in paragraph 10.8 is summarise a way forward. And what you're referring to is an acknowledgement from the council's planner that a zone type such as rural visitor or some type of zone that provides for rural visitor activities is appropriate for that land, but there's no evidence to support the bringing of the operative chapter into the proposed district plan at this point in time. So one of the ways the council's tried to approach this is see, well, we are reviewing these provisions in stage 2, and we would recommend that you consider that this land alongside those provisions in stage 2. So perhaps if I just take you through paragraph 10.8, and then I'm happy to answer any more further questions on that. So the council's position can generally be summarised as neither the council nor the panel have jurisdiction to transfer a submission over to a later stage of the plan review. What that means is a recommendation needs to be made by officers now and a recommendation made by the panel now. There is insufficient evidence before the panel at this time to insert any operative zones into the proposed plan via submission. In a number of instances, council's recommendations are that the rezoning submission has no merit and the notified zone is the most appropriate and the submission should be rejected. Despite there being a lack of evidence to bring across those operative zones at this time, council experts have acknowledged that in some instances there is merit in the general type of relief being pursued, and in those instances the council planner has recommended that the land is revisited via a variation or maybe a plan change depending on the timing when the relevant operative zone is reviewed. For those particular submissions, and I'm referring to Subclause D, in the meantime, the notified zone will be confirmed. Council acknowledges that this creates some uncertainty. In the case of those submissions seeking a rezoning from rural to either visitor accommodation subzone or rural visitor zone, there is some certainty provided to the submitter in the meantime in that the council's rural zone includes a fully discretionary activity rule for visitor accommodation provisions. In addition, if the panel includes a recommendation in its decision to revisit any of the land issues, this will subsequently form part of the council's decision. Although the panel in that decision cannot bind the council to initiate such a variation, it is a strong message to the public that the council will follow that process forward into subsequent stages of the review.
Following on from that last sentence, if the council doesn't follow that process, the submitter's left a bit high and dry. I mean, I'm anticipating that submitters may think that as soon as they get that, see that recommendation, and not, or get a decision from the council, and I'll do that later, then they might get appeals immediately because they don't trust us.
Yes, that is a possible outcome. submitted by Ed advice that they should lodge an appeal for certainty in the meantime. The starting point, of course, is that the council doesn't consider that there's any evidence at the moment that they cannot bring concerns over, and the council also doesn't want a whole variety of bespoke zones scattered around the district. So it's trying to promote an approach where there can be a complete review focused around the likes of rural visitor, visitor accommodation, industrial, etc. So in paragraph E, I speak about the discretionary activity rule in the rural zone, which does allow consent to be advanced in the meantime, which is an element of certainty to the submitter. I'm not submitting that this is a perfect solution, but based on the sort of different set of submissions before the panel, that is the approach that's been taken.
Would you explain the implications of private plan change proposals in the context of the stage review?
Private plan change requests can be made during the course of the
they can be made.
There is a process in the RMA where you consider whether one should be accepted or not. One of the reasons for not accepting a private plan change request is that the matter has been considered in the last 10 years. 2 years. available option, and I can't foreshadow what decision will be made. I am aware of a council report which talks about obviously not wanting to promote a whole lot of private plan change requests while the council was going through that review. But the council is very liable to these submissions, and the evidence that has been made by its various planners, and in the context of, I think there's about 15 of them in this hearing stream. In the upper quota, there was a smaller number, and the submission in that hearing stream was again that there was no evidence before the panel to bring one of these zone types into the proposed district plan via a submission.
I was just interested in finding out whether or not a submitter who got the come here rather than the go away message from reading the officer's section 42A report might then think about, well, what other options do I have in addition to an appeal?
Yes, well, will these appeal consent under the operative plan,
which is not planning.
No, but it is an alternative. And then there is also some of the submissions that have been made on relate to visitor accommodation provisions that were withdrawn after the plan was originally notified. And of course those provisions still need to be reviewed because they were withdrawn. So that there's some assurance there that the council is reviewing those provisions, such zones in the later stage. So there is some assurance there for those submitters. Some submitters their concern relates to rural visitor subzones, and unfortunately these situations where half the site has been notified in stage one and then half the site isn't notified in stage two, but that rural visitor half will have to be considered in stage two, and so in those examples I think there's a little bit more confidence there for the submitter as well that perhaps the whole site will be considered as one in terms of going forward. I can't get that assurance again, but that would be
sensible. Is there an option, and I am expecting immediate answer when I think about this one, whether if the panel was minded to consider that some provision should be made other than the notified zoning, that it recommend that the notified zoning not be confirmed and the only operative zoning remain in place, and that then forces the council to reconsider that zoning. Would that be within the realms of possibility?
I have thought about this. The council needs to make a decision on the redundancy mission. So,
but that could not be a decision.
Not confirming the zoning. What that essentially is would be the council withdrawing that area of land from stage one of the proposed district plan. So it is an alternative where the council could look at certain areas of land, withdraw it, and therefore no recommendation needs to be made. But I think there's no legal basis for transferring a submission over to a later stage in review. Well, recommendation needs to be made.
No, that's not transferring, is it? Mm-hmm. The council decision is that the rural, for example, certain areas will be rural. The rural zone is inappropriate, and so we are not going to have the rural zone on that land. We will have some other zone to be determined at some other time. It still creates an appeal right, doesn't it?
I think that then that would need to be withdrawn by the council, by the full council.
Yes. Although the decisions have been made by the full council anyway, don't they?
Yes, they are. Yes. So I mean, that is an option. The question then is.
So it could be a withdrawal under clause 8. Okay.
It could be, but it does raise some questions as to which land. That applies to. I guess it would have to be based on an evidential.
Oh, yes, I'm not suggesting that I'm not knowing, but I'm just trying to think of the circumstance that retains the submitter's option rather than. Well, they certainly could lodge an appeal and then wait and see what the council does.
Yes.
But of course, lodging an appeal might encourage the Environment Court to hear the appeal, which doesn't necessarily help the council.
There are also a variety of situations where I think some submitters might consider that the operative zone that currently applies to their land is not as good as the proposed district plan rural zone. So that might help some submitters in terms of drawing the land and keeping the operative zone. For example, if they had rural visitor in the operative zone. But there are other submitters where withdrawing their land and confirming the operative rural general zone might actually not be so favourable for them. Okay, almost into the actual submissions. So in paragraph 11, look, scope is of relevance to a number of submissions and also evidence that has been filed on submissions and also some sort of updated version of submitters' positions as we've worked through the evidence exchange process. Set out in Appendix 5 of these submissions is a summary of the legal principles on scope. We have covered them a number of times during the course of the hearing. I'm happy to take Commissioner Crawford and Martin through them if you wish, or if they are just a short 2 page, you can. Thank you. So matters of scope are referred to throughout the following paragraphs of these legal submissions. So turning to section 12, matters common across geographic areas. So the first is the Queenstown Airport submission. So the airport has opposed the intensification of activities sensitive to aircraft noise, or ASAN, inside the out of control boundary. And the airport and council are aligned in terms of this position within the out of control boundary. I understand there is a smaller residual difference between the two parties on this point, in that the airport, I understand, is comfortable with any zoning for a site provided that there would be a site-specific rule prohibiting ASAN, whereas in the council's position, it's not quite that straightforward in that there's a wider consideration needs to be given as to what the most appropriate zoning is. And just as by way of example, for example, business mixed use zone, it does allow for some residential activities. And there is at least one rezoning submission where the that you put some stable business mixed use is fine, provided that you cannot have residential and then.
When we get to when the council granted consents for residential activities in the out of control boundary out already, does that create a problem or an inconsistency if then the council is saying that you can't zone it for residential purposes?
That I understand is addressed through plan change 35 and the provisions that are included in there that require that the airport essentially roll out noise insulation measures within the OCB for any existing residential activities. Mm. And it's essentially a point in time where they're saying, well, no more. We need to prohibit any more ASAM moving forward from this point in time. And in terms of the activities that are already there, then they need to have various types of noise mitigation measures applied to their buildings.
So I take it from that then that the council would not now, like at the present time, issue a consent for any residential subdivision on rural zone land in the out of control boundary.
Under the operative district plan provisions,
yes.
I can't answer that.
Well, my understanding is that one of the reasons we're dealing with one Hampshire Road, which was transferred from the business zone, was because there was a proposal for residential use of it. I can't recall, but there is a suggestion in some of the evidence that a consent has been granted for that residential use. That's almost entirely within the out of control boundary.
Yes,
and that's why I'm asking about the consistency between the consent granting process and the zoning process.
Yes, I understand that's essentially what Plan Change 35 essentially tries to do in terms of, well, what's been zoned there now. You need to apply the various mitigation measures, but we're going to oppose any more rezonings within the out of control boundary and also outside the out of control boundary as I get to.
Yes, I understand, but please tell me what I'm trying to get the council's understanding, that the council has been consistent, and the council is also recommending, and Ms. Banks is recommending, that a single site that the council owns be rezoned residential, which would create the opportunity for an ASAM to go there.
Yes, I understand, it's one residential lot.
Mm.
Yes.
That equally seems to be inconsistent. So even though it is only one residential lot,
yes.
And it is a reserve at the moment, but it may cease to be a reserve at any time. Well, if it is a reserve, then would the council's next stage, when they introduce an open space zone, be the most appropriate way to say that, rather than us dealing with it now?
I would submit need to happen by variation in terms of that land being re-notified with the open space zoning and that subsequent stage. That is, of course, subject to the timing of decisions and notification of any subsequent stages. And I'm sorry, I'm not sure exactly where open space is within the stages 2 and 4.
I thought.
Which is where I think the what we spoke about before in terms of I don't think the panel can just not make a decision on a submission.
Yes, but we can recommend rejecting.
Yes,
I'm just trying to understand.
Yes, but that will still confirm the notified zone type.
Yes, which is rural.
Yes, yeah, that can certainly happen.
Yes, but what I'm trying to get a handle on is if we take that particular case. The open space zone on the reserves would require variation throughout the district because almost all the district's reserves have an underlying zoning in rural. So that wouldn't be acceptable. the question is, why is it exceptional that it be zoned residential when that is clearly contrary to this policy agreed between the council and the airport company?
Yes, I think that's a question for Ms Banks in terms of why she took an exception to that approach.
Right, okay, then I'll revert to my first one, which is residential subdivision at Hampson Road, which is within the out of control boundary. Is it the council's position that that should remain, or in fact the council had proposed that it be local shopping centre zone, as I understand it. So notwithstanding, and a local shopping centre zone can have a sense, because you can have residential on the upper floor, is it the council's position that notwithstanding that, different zoning or different actual activity approved, that should just carry on with local shopping centre zone?
Sorry, I need to set instructions on that question.
Yes, that's why I'm putting it now, so I'll give you time to think about it.
Thank you. Turning to paragraph 12.3, so this was just mentioned, it relates to the airport's opposition to rezonings outside of the out-of-control boundary. So Mr Carr's evidence for the airport is that a number of rezoning requests that seek to enable the intensification of A-Stand in an area beyond the out-of-control boundary should be rejected, and the area that Mr. Carr was referring to is identified by Mr. Chris Day in his evidence. I understand that's essentially the 50 dBA out in the noise control rather than the 55. The position
I didn't think it would be, I thought it was even more amorphous than that. I think it might be 45 in places. So that is what Mr. Day thinks they might, and Mr. Carr thinks it might be needed. If they expand the airport operations beyond the limitations imposed by designation 2.
Yes,
that's what we're really talking about.
Yes, well summarised, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and the position of the airport in taking that view, is that intensification of ASAN in this additional area has the potential to give rise to an increased risk of reverse sensitivity, which would result in the future curtailment of activities at the airport, that such proposals would likely lead to residential development in locations where levels of amenity are compromised and will increasingly become so as aircraft operations at the airport increase over time. Ms Banks covers this in her rebuttal evidence for the council. She doesn't agree with opposing rezonings in that area based on this specific point. And her evidence is that the proposed district plan required chapters reflect and should reflect the outcomes of Plan Change 35. The air noise boundaries were established through Plan Change 35 and the airport has not sought to revise them.
On the contrary, I thought they'd actually got this submission asking for them to be included in the plan.
Yes, they have. Expert conferencing was undertaken during the strategic directions hearing before Council reached its required position on Chapters 3 and 4. The airport is not given primacy within Chapter 3, and land outside the out of control boundary is in principle appropriate for urban development. I also refer you to the extensive evidence and legal submissions presented by the airport in a number of hearing streams, which are, in summary, very supportive of Plan Change 35 and the process that went through the extensive hearing and environment court proceedings, and the recommendations to the panel that it should not challenge or attempt to relitigate the merits of that work within Plan Change 35. So overall, Council's view is that Plan Change 35 has provided for the appropriate protection of the airport and it appears that the airport is essentially coming back for a second car for the Cherry. It's not considered appropriate or necessary for the proposed district plan to go beyond Land Change 35 as the airport is now seeking, particularly where the airport are not pursuing an amendment to its out of control boundary. So moving into section 13, into group 1A, as I did mention earlier, I have addressed some submissions where legal issues have arisen during the course of preparing for the hearing. So in relation to Skyline's submission, they are seeking the establishment of a new commercial tourism and recreation subzone on Bob's Peak, and it would cover the facilities currently operated by Skyline and also areas further beyond those operations. The area is zoned rural, and also part of it is zoned Queenstown Town Centre in the proposed district plan. It is within an outstanding natural landscape, it's within two designated recreation reserves, and the Ben Lomond and Queenstown Hill Reserve Management Plan 2005, which must be had regard to. Ms Evans is the planner who has considered this from the council's perspective. And her concerns as to the proposed subzone are set out in her evidence. And I just note that the concerns set out in Ziptrek's legal submissions are also adopted. Two jurisdictional issues do arise in relation to this hearing. First I'll take you through paragraph 13.3. So council remains of the view that Skyline had not provided sufficient information or assessment on the subsite to support the relief it seeks. This means that the council and submitted statements to Patrick have not been able to examine the potential effects of the proposal, and it is unclear what level and nature of further development Skyline proposes within the reserve, what level of increased patronage and built development the subzone might deliver, what effects this future development is expected to have, and how these effects are proposed to be avoided, remedied or mitigated. Just by way of example, traffic effects have not been adequately addressed in order to properly assess effects on the transport network, and the requirements of Section 32 have not been met. Mr. Brown, in his rebuttal evidence, observes that the scale of the proposed subzone is considerably larger than the gondola upgrade for which Skyline has recently sought resource consent, and that is by way of a direct referral to the Environment Court. In relation to Councils Ben Lomond and Queenstown Hill Reserve Management Plan, Council for Ziptrek has confirmed that shall have regard to means that the Reserve Management Plan must be given material consideration, but the plan does not necessarily need to be followed. He admits that the Reserve Management Plan is highly relevant and should be given weight. Mr. Brown's evidence is that the Reserve Management Plan does not anticipate the scale of development in the proposed subzone, and this has not been assessed by Skyline, which is submitted to be another gap in Mr. Dent's evidence. In relation to the two issues of jurisdiction, the first relates to the subzone boundaries, and Mr. Dent's evidence is that the lower terminal and the top terminal areas have been extended, and this is in terms of the version he promotes in his evidence. But that the proposed alterations are within scope because they are carrying fashion of boundaries rather than introducing significantly greater areas. And he considers that no parties are prejudiced by the changes. From the council's perspective, it's unclear what proportion of those areas was included in the submission version of the subzone given the scale of the proposed subzone, and without seeing the new proposed boundaries overlaid on the primary submission. So on the information and plans provided, it is not possible to determine whether the changes sought in Mr. Dent's evidence are within scope, and Council invites Skyline to provide further information during the presentation of its case. I note also that Dr. Reid has recommended a no-build area or the movement of the boundary in an area adjacent to the lower reaches of the existing Rouge Cheddar. The second issue is that in the primary submission, Skyline asked for a new subzone to be inserted into the rural zone. And it was identified in the Council Section 42A that part of the area where they sought the subzone sat over the Queenstown Town Centre zone. so not just over the rural zone. So Mr. Dent's evidence in response to this is that the lower terminal site needs to be rezoned from Queenstown town centre to rural, so that the subzone provisions can apply to this site. Skyline's primary submission did not seek to change the underlying zone for the lower terminal, and the council maintains its position that there is no scope to seek rezoning of the lower terminal site to rural, and that is not a reasonably foreseeable consequence of the submission. It is accepted, however, that the submission sought that the subzone apply over that area of land, and there is likely scope to insert the new subzone into the Queenstown town centre zone, but there would need to be additional objectives and policies to make the various statutory tests, which we don't have at this point in time.
A question which may reflect my lack of familiarity with this particular district. Why is this called a subzone? Why isn't it just a zone? It would eliminate those complications.
The submitter has created the subzone.
I know, it's not the only example in this where there are subzones, and they don't, to me, they don't seem to be subzones because they're distinctly different from the sort of overlying zone, if you can use that term. Is there some residual, is the overlying zone had some residual effect on a subzone?
Yes, so the objectives and policies of the underlying zone still apply. Of course, the subzone itself needs to meet the, for example, the rural zone's objectives and policies before you then go to the strategic one.
Some of these are so different. But how could they meet the objectives and policies of the rural zone, for example?
Yes, well, I guess that's a test for the evidence before you as to whether they do, and perhaps goes to the council's position that sometimes these zones and the activity anticipated within them are not appropriate, for example, within the rural zone. The gondola, QPL's gondola might be an example of that. But, I mean, clearly that is... an ONL, and it is zone rural, so it is essentially, I guess, a planning response to either provide an overlay or a subzone within a particular area. It is perhaps an approach to planning in the district that has come through the operative plan as well. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Some of the rezoning for you are seeking essentially new zones as well. Mm-hmm. For example, the rural visitor is a zone in its offer version, is a zone in its own right. Mm-hmm. It also may one less, I guess, steep in terms of considering the relevant objectives and policies of the plan if it wasn't zone in its own right, because you would. You would have to basically to get a subzone in these new subzones. The submitters are promoting basically a specific and objective policy that applies just to their subzone. Whereas if it was a zone in its own right, that they would probably just be relevant objectives and policies. But it goes to the structure of the plan, ultimately. I don't think I need to take you through paragraphs 13.8 to 13.10. This is just a note that Mr. Dent's referred to legal advice he obtained that the council's right to reply provisions are not binding, and he has assessed the zones against the notified versions. Yes, Mr. Dent is correct, the council's right to reply is not binding. We've sort of been through that in some detail in terms of resort to part two, etc. But council has. In using that version of the provisions, taken into account all of the evidence that's been filed by both the council and submitters during the course of the hearing streams leading up to these rezonings. The reply recommendations represent council's current position, and it is submitted to be both logical, efficient, and the best approach for council's experts to refer to and rely on council's most up-to-date position.
Isn't it just the two sides, if you like, the standard which version they prefer to justify them?
Yes, and it is interesting because the evidence then does talk about changes that they want made to those provisions through submission anyway. So to be, I guess, reasonably frank, the notified version of the plan doesn't represent any party's position generally. Not all of the provisions, some haven't been submitted on, but you know, generally the notified provisions don't represent the submitter's version or the council's version now.
Now, there's just a request that we have that hadn't occurred to me, but my fellow commissioners pointed out. The reply versions that the council has provided are all, in each case, an appendix to the reporting officer's reply statement. They're not easy to find, and it would be, I'm just wondering if the council could organise for a reply version to be made available on the website.
And yes,
that would just simplify things.
We have an
idea of
the council's bundle. The reply version of the chat is in the council's bundle.
Are they? Right.
Yes, so what.
So they will be available on the website that way.
Yes, they are.
We've had to go down several layers to find them.
I remember it now, Mr. Jeff.
Yes. Yeah. So they are tab number 1 through to 25. Of the first bundle of documents that was filed, and there are some additional chapters that have been provided in the supplementary bundle and the second supplementary bundle. For example, the subdivision chapter, a number of we hadn't filed all our replies at the time in the first bundle, so we had to provide some more chapters at a later time. In addition, site-specific rules relating to subdivision that related to some zones and areas of land were considered in the relevant hearing stream. And we have provided within the bundle one version of the subdivision chapter which incorporates all of the council's recommendations on that chapter, and it has been filed with that particular hearing as well.
I
think
of course
seeing
that. You mean that it incorporates, for instance, Ms. Jones recommended amendments from the Queenstown Town Centre Zone in Chapter 36 on noise? I don't recall that being filed with the Stream 5 panel. I know it's there.
Yes, we've only done that for subdivision.
Oh, I see.
For example, Ms. Jones' recommendations on subdivision in the Jack's Point Zone were made in the Jack's Point hearing stream, but of course relevant to the subdivision hearings panel. So we've just provided a complete version of that chapter. Okay. Glenda Drive. This relates to, I think we've actually already covered this. So Shift Holdings Limited and BNZL Properties made a single submission in relation to two sites at Glenda Drive. Part of the Shift Holdings site was notified part rural in stage 1, and the rest of the site is operative district plan industrial A. The second BNZL site is all notified rural. The submission opposed the industrial zoning, which wasn't notified as the one, and sought business mixed use zone over the whole of both sites. Ms. Evans has recommended rejecting all of the rezoning across those two sites, and in making this recommendation, she did consider the operative industrial A portion of the site, so she considered that site as a whole. In her view, the business mixed use zone would result in legal intensification that is inconsistent with the majority of the Glenda Drive industrial area. She also considers that applying business mixed use to a small portion of land that is part of a wider industrial area and contains industrial uses would be an inconsistent zoning approach. Moving on to section 14, Franklin, that's
north. I wanted to call it Quail Flats, but Mr. Chairman didn't agree. There was no rise in it.
Franklin Flats, all
it is. There's no liberation, that's the problem.
Matt Banks was going to address you on this, but in relation to the question earlier about the Housing Infrastructure Fund, the application that was filed with the government essentially covers a wider area than what the government has confirmed, and the confirmed portion of the Housing Infrastructure Fund only relates to the part that Ms Banks has recommended be zoned high density residential.
Right.
So I believe that Ms Banks' recommendations are consistent in terms of the area that the Housing Infrastructure Fund proposal applies to. So it unfortunately wasn't all that clear from the government's media announcement, but what they have confirmed will go to the next business stage is actually smaller and more refined areas compared to what the council applied for.
Is somebody going to be able to illustrate that exactly for us?
Mr. Kessler might be able to help you with that as well,
yeah,
because he's been involved in this
process. Well, I'm going to ask you later if you could get Ms. Banks to prepare a map for us in dealing with this area, showing some of the controls, and I'll get you that later, but it would be helpful if on that it could, because it has this weight, be shown in grey what it is the government is actually granted the funding, the potential funding for. Just so that it's clear.
It hasn't granted anything yet, but it's on to the next step of the process. Yeah. But yes, we can add that onto the map. Yes.
Absolutely.
So from my perspective, the key question really is scope and the approach that's been taken to this area, given that a number of rezoning submissions were made for Franklin Flats North. On page 36, so across the wider area, the notified zones range from rural to medium density. And in terms of the submissions, some sought residential zonings while others sought commercial or industrial. A number of submissions across the wider site also focus on that of infrastructure and transport connections. As already mentioned, the out-of-control boundary covers part of the area, and therefore the airport approaches any ASAN within a specific area. But the overall scope ranges from industrial to rural, with all levels of residential and commercial zoning in between. Because of the complexity of the area, Ms Banks has assessed the entire area at a strategic level and then assessed each submission individually. In terms of traffic, Ms Wendy Banks has raised a number of concerns about traffic issues, and in her evidence in chief was only prepared to accept a limited amount of mixed-use development or residential that fell within the same anticipated traffic generation. Mr Sizemore for the agency, Transport Agency, has subsequently provided evidence that the proposed upgrades on State Highway 6 are not designed to cater for large increases in traffic volumes that would be associated with significant areas of intensified commercial or industrial activity. Based on the Transport Agency's evidence, Ms Wendy Banks agrees that a residential zoning from Hanson Road through to Ferry Hill Drive would be more appropriate. I understand the council and the agency are therefore aligned in terms of supporting a residential rather than business mixed use or industrial zoning in this area. Mr Sizemore, again for the agency, has also rebutted Mr Carr's transport evidence for five specific submitters. Mr Carr has disagreed with Ms Wendy Banks's concern that development of the land as business mixed use would lead to adverse effects on the State Highway 6 Hawthorne Drive roundabout. And Mr Sizemore's rebuttal evidence for the agency is that Mr Carr's analysis used a number of assumptions with regard to traffic generation and possible direction of travel from the proposed business mixed-use zone, that there remains a significant uncertainty between those assumptions and what may eventuate in practice. And that, although Mr Carr had used the projected traffic volumes for 2025, the agency says it would be prudent to consider a longer time frame of 30 years instead. Further, with regard to Mr Carr's suggestion of adding a third lane to the State Highway 6 Hawthorne Drive roundabout, Mr Sizemore confirms that the agency has no plans to increase the capacity of the roundabout in this way and does not generally favour three-lane roundabouts. It is submitted to not be a valid measure for mitigating the council and agency's concerns. Other than that, I will leave you to point any questions on that area to to Ms Banks and the relevant experts. It is obviously rather complex, and that is one of the reasons we will have all the relevant experts available at the same time for questions. But briefly turning to the Wakatipu Basin Land Use Planning Study, the Wakatipu Basin area is subject to a specific land use planning study that was commissioned by Council in response to a panel minute in 2016. As noted in Ms Banks' strategic section 42A evidence, it is likely that the development of a planning framework for all will lead, or at least some of the Wakatipu Basin will require a variation to the proposed district plan. Its relevance to this hearing stream, a number of submissions made on land in the vicinity of the study at Lake Johnson, Tucker Beach have been allocated to this hearing stream. These submissions are partly located within and partly located outside of the area covered by the study, and they are listed in Ms Banks' evidence. The evaluation in this hearing stream has regard to the findings of the study. In particular, the landscape evidence of Dr. Reed refers to the study findings on an area of 94.5 hectares to the north of Lake Johnson, where a submitter is seeking rezoning from rural to low density residential and rural residential. Ms. Kimberly Banks has recommended rejecting this rezoning due to concerns about servicing and hazards. There is no certainty at this point in time as to whether this particular land will be included in the Wakatipu Basin variation or not. No recommendations have been made by council officers to full council at this time. So it's just an extra element of complexity that is a particular thing. Turning
to the end of the day, the Wakatipu Basin planning study is only a matter of information that can be put before us.
That's right. Mm. Yes. I guess the point from a legal perspective is we cannot preempt whether that land will be re-notified or not through the variation. And it's a recommendation has been made on the evidence before it, and Dr. Reed has taken into account the study's findings. Mm. Turning to Mount Crystal, this submitter has sought a rezoning from low density residential to part medium density residential. Over the northern half of a site, and the other part they have sought high density residential. Alternatively, the submitter sought that the whole site be zoned medium density residential. Mr. Dent's planning evidence now abandons the split zoning and seeks that all of the site be high density residential. Mr. Dent asserts that there is scope because geotechnical constraints on the site mean that the potential buildable area for high density residential is limited to 1.27 hectares, which of course is a smaller area of land than the portion of the site that they sought to be zoned to high density. Council accepts that it is a reasonably foreseeable outcome that 1.49 hectares of high density residential could be provided for within the relief sought, and the amended relief in essence spreads the higher density development over the wider site. If that logic is to be followed, the submitter would presumably accept the restriction of development in terms of the overall high density development on the site. In any event, however, Ms. Devlin has recommended rejecting the high density residential and accepted a rezoning of the entire site to medium density. She considers that high density residential would be out of character in this location and would not meet the objectives of Chapter 9, in particular Objective 9.2.1, which support high density zoning in close proximity to the town centre. She also relies on Ms. Wendy Banks' evidence that the distance between the site and the town centre makes it unsuitable for high density residential. Turning to the Hensman and Southern Lakes Holdings submission, I just need to make couple of corrections to this sentence. So the site on the northern side of the Frankton Arm was notified as low density residential with, and if I could add in there, an ODP, visitor accommodation subzone, and then add the word shown. over the southwest portion. So I'll just read that again. The site on the northern side at the Franklin Arm was notified as low density residential within operative district plan, visitor accommodation subzone, shown over the southwest portion.
Didn't the council withdraw the VA subzone, which is why it was a proposed VA subzone that was withdrawn in December 2015?
Yes, you are correct. Please delete my corrections. I think what was withdrawn was that the visitor accommodation provisions were formally withdrawn under state.
Which included the subzones.
Yes, which in essence meant that the subzones had no provisions sitting with them. And then the council tidied that up through a clause 16 correction to that.
Yes, the one that was in the middle of last year.
Yes.
Yes. Because they were nugatory.
Yes. So I'll take you through that again. My apologies. The site was notified as low density residential with a visitor accommodation subzone over the southwest portion. The submitter supported the visitor accommodation subzone. Albeit with concerns about the lack of any associated text provisions, and sought high density residential over the remainder of the site outside the visitor accommodation subzone. So the low density residential zone, which was sitting under the visitor accommodation subzone, was not challenged. So then the visitor accommodation provisions were withdrawn, and then in December 2016, the proposed plan map 37 was amended to remove the visitor accommodation subzone. So Mr. Walsh has asserted that because the visitor accommodation subzone, delete and ODP adaptation, has been removed from the map, the rezoning request now extends over the entire site. And he therefore seeks the high density zoning for the entire site, or alternatively medium density. The council's view is that there is no scope in the primary submission to seek high density or medium density over the entire site. A potential further submitter would not have foreseen that the entire site might be rezoned as a result of the submission. So essentially what Mr. Walsh is saying is that there's two parts of the site, and because the visitor accommodation has been withdrawn, he's arguing that his submission should then apply to the entire site. In fact, it was only the visitor accommodation subzone which was supported. So it's unfortunate chain of events, but council's position is that the primary submission doesn't provide scope to rezone the entire site.
Can I ask a question? This might be a better put to the planner. In what way would the outcome of the visitor accommodation subzone differ from the outcome of the high density residential development?
I will have to.
I know what that's your planner.
Okay,
thank you.
So moving to paragraph 15.6, the Division of Trustees Limited. So Ms. Deslin, in the Section 42A report, recommended rejecting the rezoning sought in the primary submission at Belfast Terrace in Manchester Place. This was a rezoning from low density to high density residential. The planning evidence of Ms. Leith then sought a rezoning to the lower density medium density residential, and Ms. Devlin in her rebuttal has recommended accepting this rezoning. There's clearly no issue of scope there. But Ms. Leith then asserts in her evidence that there is scope through submission 718, which is her client's submission, and 391 to rezone the entire low-density residential portion of Queenstown Hill to medium-density residential. This isn't a material point, but it's accepted that submission 391 provides such scope, but submission 718 does not, as it was specific to the sites owned by the submitter. In relation to the entire low-density portion of Queenstown Hill, Ms. Devlin recommends rejection of the rezoning, not due to any scope concerns, but because she considers the land is generally well-suited for low-density residential development. is not close enough to the town centre to be suitable for higher densities and cannot be accommodated by existing infrastructure capacity.
I think before we go on to the next section, we will adjourn for lunch. It will take some time. It's probably sensible not to break that one.
Not happy with that. I think I probably had about 15 minutes left, I suspect.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll adjourn to 2 o'clock.
Thank you.